All right.
Oh, man. Welcome to Just the Dis. This is a podcast about Blu-rays. My name's Brian Sauer. That was my friend Brendan Small on the keyboard. Or the, god damn it.
This is the Korg
the Nebulizer.
It's
no,
the
Nebulizer?
Korg Chaos-ulator.
I always fuck it up.
And then, like I said, this is...
See, it's people got, just totally picture you at a fucking...
I know, it's not. It's more, I'm doing this all with one finger.
It's a pretty cool little device.
It's a pretty cool device, yeah. These are available. Actually, you can download an app.
Yes,
there's
yes.
There's a Korg app.
I still got to get this app. But
it's probably
I
like 20 bucks, but worth it.
Somebody was posting to me on Instagram that they just did the Cobra 10 to Midnight double feature, which I I put into my stories.
Yeah.
And then another person who listens to the show said they can't see the Cobra poster without hearing your synthesizer.
Every day.
Whatever he says. I forgot what it is.
But yes, that voice, I'm like, that is awesome.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I mean, that is kind of the sound. We get a little bit of that in part of what we're going to talk about today.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Indeed.
And this is a bit of a, I don't know, a Matthew McConaughey appreciation double whammy, which is which came out of a long conversation, or I think this became a very creative double feature, kind of a Blu-ray review, I guess.
Yeah, we were talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation, aka The Return of Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
yeah.
Aka Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4.
Sure.
And The Beach Bum, and I thought it might be interesting to talk about McConaughey at the beginning,
yeah.
And McConaughey now.
Yes.
And it was interesting to watch both.
Yeah.
Well, I had only seen Texas Chainsaw, and I had seen it in the 90s at some point.
Sure, I did too. I saw it, again, I worked in a movie theater in Boston. So I saw just about everything that happened from like fall of 93 on, and this happened to be one of the movies there.
Well, I didn't even realize it got like a theatrical release. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think it did, or I'm conflating that with having rented it, but I'm pretty sure I saw it, and I remember...
I don't doubt it.
Here's what I remember, and the reason that I urge people to watch this is because, I'm not sure why, other than it had a visceral, menacing, horrible, putrid impression. It left that impression on me, and sometimes when a film does that, I have to take a second look, and there are moments in this thing after having... This is like when your old man catches you smoking, and you smoke the whole pack. That's what this podcast is. I had to smoke the whole pack of The Next Generation Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I do really appreciate because I think it's got a lot of, well, geez, it's got a lot of very independent spirit. And then also it's one of the things where I think this group of actors really work together well to build some of the most vile menace that I've ever seen. And the actors in question are, of course, Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger, which you wouldn't expect.
Yeah. You gotta watch get into cars with strangers these days. I heard about an old man once, picked up a little girl on the side of the road, chopped both her arms off, stuffed her in the culvert, left her for dead. God, I fucking hate that. I mean, that sorry son of a bitch didn't have shit for an imagination. How fucking simple can you get?
Stop, you're scaring me.
Scaring you? You're not scared. You don't know shit about being scared, little girl. Not yet. You want scared? You want scared? Have a look behind you. Have a look. Yeah, how about that, huh? Look again, goddammit.
No.
Go ahead, look
no.
again.
I think I want you to stop and let me out.
You think? Or do you know? Huh? Go ahead and have a look. You better look.
No.
You don't want to look.
No, no.
What's your goddamn problem?
Okay. If you stop, I'll look.
You want it to stop.
Stop it. Ow. Ow.
Can I have a look at that?
Ow.
Have a look at that.
Ow.
Look at that. How about that?
Stop.
Who's that? Who's that? Huh?
Huh? Oh, God.
Yeah, of course you gotta throw in a little something extra. Just let them know it ain't Saturday morning cartoons, if you know what I mean.
What's gonna happen to me?
You think I give a goddamn what happens to you?
Are you letting me go?
You figure it out. It's your goddamn life.
I don't understand.
Well, Welcome to the real world.
No. Renee, who's got like a huge movie coming out too. The Judy Garland movie. She's got the big Judy movie.
That's right. I just saw the trailer for
that. Right. So Judy Garland. She's playing Judy Garland. So this is like a huge... And I see that trailer and I think, oh, I'll go to the movies to see that movie. I'm very interested to see what she does with that role. I really am.
No, she looks great in it, you know? And it's light years from this movie. And she's very good in this movie.
Yes. Sorry.
But yeah, I think part of it for me, all that I remembered from seeing it was it came into the video store I was working at the time.
Yeah.
I watched it on VHS.
Yeah.
And I think I finished it, but I hated it at the time. Mm-hmm. It was just as you say, a vile experience, and I couldn't reconcile it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my taste in horror films has become, I'd like to think, a little bit more sophisticated than it was in, you know, 95, 96.
Or less sophisticated.
Maybe not. Yeah, I mean, many people would say less, certainly. But I think it's one of those movies that I can't deny the power of the performances.
Mm-hmm.
McConaughey is insane in this movie. I mean,
yeah, he is. He's in his hypnotic McConaughey. Like, just from this is... This is his first gig, maybe, or his second gig. This is like right around. So this is 1993-ish when they filmed it. It came out in 94. And this is right around the time that Dazed and Confused had happened. So it was almost immediately after, immediately before.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it was before because I think they talked about the crew from Dazed, some of those people coming over to this. But I'm not sure that Dazed was even out yet. Well, yeah, I think it was like chasing it when it came out and then they released this.
Right. Yeah. So it's early. You're in, what, Austin, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And you've got Kim Henkel.
Mm-hmm. Writer of the original Texas Chainsaw.
Exactly. So,
which I didn't know until like this week.
Yeah, yeah. He wrote the first one, and you can see there's some kind of connective tissue because the fact that the production design, I think, really kind of nails some of the innards of the house, even though it's not supposed to be the same house or even really the same characters necessarily.
Mm.
And then there's a big kind of left turn that I think leaves a lot of people really irritated in this movie as well, which isn't a spoiler story-wise, but it's the fact that Leatherface and his family and everybody may or may not be part of the Illuminati. Which is I know normally we don't spoil things, but I think this is an interesting talking point because there's a divisive quality that this film has where some like real lovers of Texas Chainsaw Massacre do not observe this as canon. And I get it.
Hmm, that's interesting. I mean, you know, it's funny because one thing that's happened to me since I saw it the first time is I have since seen Texas Chainsaw 2, which I don't know if I'd seen when I saw it.
Yeah, I hadn't.
And I hadn't seen 3, which I actually really like. I really like Leatherface, personally.
Yeah.
So that gave me a new perspective on it and kind of like, this is what these movies are. They are that menace. Menace is the great key word to
these
films.
Well, I think about, I think I'd watched the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I don't think I really understood it in the way that I do now. When I see it now, it's like an art film. And I think the sequences that happen, for example, when they pick up the hitchhiker, and there's like an 8-minute sequence of him acting so bizarre and a bunch of people just in a little VW bus not knowing how to behave around this crazy guy who's talking about killing cows so that they die horribly.
I was at the slaughterhouse.
I got an uncle that works at the slaughterhouse.
Hey, my brother worked there. My grandfather, too.
My family's always been in me.
My whole family are Draculas.
Hey, man, did you go in that slaughter room or whatever they call it? The place where they shoot the cattle in the head with that big air gun thing.
Oh, that gun's no good.
I was in there once with my uncle.
The old way. With a sledge. See, that was better. They died better that way.
Like, he's telling this soliloquy, and we're cutting away to these people feeling tension and stress, and they don't know what to do because they're polite. And they can't just say, hey, motherfucker, get the fuck out. Go so far away from us. But they're like, hello, how do you do? Well, it's nice to be in your part of town. And then they find he starts cutting himself. He starts doing all the stuff that Matthew McConaughey kind of embodies later on in Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, that's right. I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah, so there are some kind of echoes here and there. But I didn't truly understand that it's more than a slasher film. It's got so much crazy mood. But going back even before that, this is a classic trope. This is a classic story. This is the old Dark House, basically, you know, which is like, what, 1940-something?
Yeah.
It's late, an old Universal.
Yeah. 40s, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it's definitely like the, in this case, kids on their prom night.
Yes.
Get lost, seemingly relatively close to their high school. It doesn't seem like they went
too far. Doesn't seem like they went too far, no.
No, so, but the, interestingly, but you know, that's, there's something about this movie that definitely doesn't, I don't question that, because I'm
right.
Like, they've been sucked and folded into this, whatever, these, this universe that these people exist in, this dark
yeah.
place, you know?
This strange world where people were for the first time. Well, not for the first time, because it happens in a totally different way in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, where they're trying to win chili cook-offs with human meat, you know, and shit like that. So they're kind of living in society. This one kind of acknowledges that they do have jobs outside of just lingering at home and screaming at each other.
Yeah, it's really interesting yeah. that they seem to have some kind of business set up, you know, like
yeah,
he drives
like,
a tow truck.
They're
and
keeping the lights on somehow.
She, this strange woman that we meet, who seems like she's going to be helpful, but then maybe isn't going to be, is talking about real estate, I think she sells, and how...
She seems like she's a real estate broker, and she's got a little office.
Says something about how her implants have really doubled her commissions or something.
So,
so I'm like, well, she's doing well,
yeah.
but yeah, it's surprising that they could keep up appearances.
Yeah, yeah, and she's somehow folded into this screwy family, because it seems like she's got a thing going with Matthew McConaughey, who doesn't seem like he's really tied down to any one female character in the movie. But we're going all over the place. This is the old Dark House, which is basically a couple or some socialized people from the regular world break down, and then all hell breaks loose the second they enter anywhere near the woods. So that's what happens here. Couples. We've got people that we're meant to dislike a great deal. We have Renee Zellweger, who is kind of frumpy and downplays her looks in the top of this movie, and slowly makes a transformation as she becomes more empowered.
Yeah, and there's a big key scene that's left out of the film that we see in the director's cut that gives some backstory to her character and really shifts a lot of things.
It's interesting.
Her.
It's funny because I see... So we have two versions in this Blu-ray.
Yes.
So this is a Scream Factory Blu-ray, and it's got the regular theatrical cut, and then a cut that's probably about, like, seriously, what, 6 to 9 minutes shorter, that somebody made the decision without Kim Hankel's knowing to cut it down. So I think he's got, it sounds like in the commentary, that he was not so happy about that. But
yeah, had a little thing where the commentary is listed on the website, and it's not on the packaging. So if you were to look at this disc like a moron like me and go, oh, it looks like there's just some interviews and two cuts of the movie and that's it. But there's this commentary track, which is moderated by Phil Nobile Jr. from Fangoria.
Right.
Includes Kim Hankel and Joe Stevens. One other dude who was on set filming stuff.
Yes, a guy... that's the only thing about this Blu-ray is that they promised some kind of behind-the-scenes thing, and it's maybe it's a hidden Easter egg that nobody found.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find it, and you couldn't find it, right?
Nope.
And I think some other sites couldn't find it. But
anyway, two cuts of the film, and the director's cut is in SD, but includes some of these key scenes, which are pretty big in terms of the
film. Well, they really set up that here's Renee Zellweger, and she's got some abusive stepfather, and she is... taking it, I mean, basically not fighting back, and then at some point in this movie, she's going to have to like take all of her rage and anger and fight back. So that's her big arc is she even dresses down, we think, right? Because she's being bothered by this guy who's with her mother.
Yeah.
And it's a really quick scene, and you don't really see his face, and it's just gone.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but it definitely does make a difference, and I can see why Kim Hankel would be upset to have it excised.
I mean, that turn is still there. We still see that, but it's funny. I only know the movie without it, and it still kind of does the same thing for the most part, but I see it now, and there's something that happens in this movie also. Sometimes this happens with great movies where the actors kind of take over, where you have a director who's, you know, and this happens also often where a director's worried about the shot, about how much light there is or isn't, what's happening with the, you know, the makeup effects, are they sticking on, are they falling off, whatever it is. And then the actors all kind of get together and say, we're going to do this ourselves, and we're going to act, and we're going to kind of push each other. And that's what I think happened here, because you've got a bunch of people, this whole movie was shot at night, and for about a month, they all had to hang out at night, and and just change their sleeping hours. And then it's kind of turned into summer camp. It's super hot, still hot in the night, and they're sweating, and there are mosquitoes everywhere, and they're in Texas, dead of summer. Oh, ho, ho, ho.
Sounds terrible.
I know. For a guy whose skin is almost pale blue, it sounds like a nightmare of hot weather. I can't handle the heat. But yeah, so I really feel like this is one of those movies where they got together and they really started pushing each other. And the most menacing, the most fucked up scenes that I see are the ones with Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey in them.
Yes.
Where they're actually manhandling and spitting onto each other and dragging each other around. And it's just torturous. It looks like people are truly experiencing pain. And that's the part where I can't believe that this movie went that far. And that's the part that where I come back to. Because most movies, you feel like they are pulling their punches. They are not hurting each other. This movie doesn't feel like that. This movie feels like people are getting mowed down by each other.
Best workout ever.
Best workout ever?
Yeah, live chainsaw. That's some motivation to get running. Run. Fast. It was very low budget, so we all shared a tiny Winnebago that the producer of the film, it belonged to him, it was his personal camper. Yeah, so, you know, makeup was the front seats, and then there was a table in the middle for hair, and then there was a tiny little curtain back by the bathroom that was where you put your prom dress and your flower on.
Are you the one that moved the cars?
Listen, either you want to ride or you don't, it's up to you.
And friends, you know, friends for life. McConaughey, Robert Jacks, who played Leatherface, he's passed now, but he was one of my favorites. I was so grateful, and I was so excited, because I had done a little bit here, a little bit there, but no one had ever trusted me with a role before to carry a film. It was ridiculous. It was how we pulled that off. I have no idea. I'm sure none of it was legal, anything that we did. It was a little bit dangerous. But what an experience. And it's like kamikaze filmmaking. Just get it done.
And Leatherface himself is a really interesting new menacing character who's howling and bellowing the whole time and screaming and dragging a woman down the hallway, kicking and screaming. And it's some of those shots. I see those and I think those are believable action documentary style things that kind of remind me of the original one. And that's why I think this is a movie. This movie went there where a lot of movies don't go that far. And that's what I've always been intrigued by, is how far this movie went.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I
it's repugnant. I mean, it's vile. It's meant to be vile. You're not supposed to, like,
yeah, I mean,
get excited, or maybe.
I could see certain people, but the thing for me, I think, is because I have certain attachments to Renee Zellweger, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, Jerry Maguire and these other movies that she would do later. There's things about seeing her tortured that are
difficult.
And seeing her cry in a movie is actually almost exclusively played for comedy these days.
Right.
So when she cries in this movie, it's a weird feeling where I'm like, oh, this is different.
It's horrible.
I want to laugh because I'm used to laughing at her crying because those scenes are meant to be like that.
Right.
This is obviously not that.
Yeah. This is a movie that also has like some like very strange dark humor in it too, where they are playing some moments for laughs.
Mm.
But few and far between, most of them are, I don't know. This is one of the, every once in a while I'll dare someone to watch something. This is like, but this is partially why I like doing this podcast, is because every once in a while there are these little hints of movies and I'm like, oh, that movie was so weird. What was it? And I try to figure it out, to figure out why it got stuck in my head. I mean, here we are. We're talking about Cobra. We're talking about 10 to Midnight, all these movies. The Entity is like a horrible, horrible movie about ghost rape. But there's no one else makes a movie. No one else made that movie. And it's stuck in my head for some crazy, well, for every reason, because there's nothing like it. And this one is more vile and more repugnant, I think, than, I can't think of a movie that is equal to this. I mean, there are movies like Star 80 that make me feel just disgusting, but I think it's also theatrical and really good character work and really good directing and really good acting. This movie has really great acting, and by two people who would go on to become, there's a reason that they became stars, because they really, really did not screw around. They really were completely in on this film.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And McConaughey has like a great story about getting cast in this movie. And
yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, it's really fun to hear that.
So as an actor from Texas, what's it like being in a Texas Chainsaw Massacre film?
The classic. I mean, I'd never even, I'd seen the original that Tobe Hooper did, but it was a It was carny, man. It was. We were shooting in 115-degree weather, myself and Renee Zellweger, about 16-hour days, and it was, I'll say carny, it was a lot of fun. And it was like anything goes. Yeah. It was anything goes. I actually have been offered the part of a role of a guy who shows up on a motorcycle at the beginning of the movie, and at the end of the movie rides off with Renee Zellweger, sort of a Romeo to Juliet role. Yeah. That was never in the film. And when I went in to go, and I was all packed up to drive out to Hollywood because I just graduated college, right? I pull up to that audition to meet with the director with my truck and my U-Haul. I go inside. The director says, Kim Engel says, do you know anybody who'd be right for the Vilma role? This is the role that I played, the killer with the trucker and the record service and stuff. And I said, no. And I thought of two friends that I knew from acting class, and I brought them up to him. And he goes, okay, I'll give him a call. I leave, shake his hand, go out. I remember I opened my truck door, started to step in, and I went, I want to read for that. Shut the door. I went back in, and I said, do you mind if I read for the Vilma part? He goes, no. We looked around. There's a secretary behind the desk, and he goes, all right, and went in the kitchen, got a spoon, and he goes, scare the shit out of her. And so we threw furniture around, had her pinned up against the wall, acted like the spoon was a knife, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he goes, now act like your mechanical leg is all messed up and did all this stuff. 5 minutes later, he goes, it's great. You want the part? And I was like, yeah.
Amazing. Renee Zellweger also has some fond memories of it, which is interesting.
You know, yeah, yeah. And you don't hear a lot of that. And you don't, obviously, they don't show up on this DVD, or this Blu-ray. Sorry, I never said DVD. I only said Blu-ray. But there, this movie feels like it's swept under the rug in a lot of different ways. And I think because it's, maybe it just went a little too horrible in some ways.
Yeah.
And I know some people truly, truly hate this and do not accept this as canon. And at the time, I didn't take these movies so seriously that I was offended by it. I just thought it was totally grotesque and those moments were played really well.
Yeah. I think it's weird for me because I have a similar feeling with it than I do to Texas Chainsaw 2, which is, you know, a better movie in some ways, but it's mm-hmm. a similar sense of menace and torture and comedy, I guess.
There's, I mean, so here's something that they do in these movies is, and this is like Toby Hooper, like in 2, they're like dancing with corpses. And I think in 3 too, and they're really playing with horrible dead things and they're just doing these vile, vile things. And the second one is played a lot more for comedy. And this world is so wretched. And when I go back and I look at the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I look at this house, too, that is such a horrible, nightmarish place with, like, chicken feathers on the floor, chairs made of bones. And this is, like, before they had a name for it. These are hoarders who have magazines and things stacked up. And you can't even – the doorways are narrow. Everything about it is nightmarish. And I think they did it. I think they made this movie just as nightmarish. And I think production design nailed it. It felt so gross. There are those moments where they're all sitting in the same room. And it's just like a family squabble turned to a million. And it's what a sweaty, nightmarish world this is. So
yeah,
no, so there you go.
Production design is great. I mean, there's like one of my favorite touches is there's a wall of keys.
Yeah,
that apparently McConaughey's character drives a tow truck and he has a tendency to kill people and run them over with his tow truck or whatever.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Keep their car keys, and so he's got a wall of keys.
He is so interesting in this movie. The first time we meet Matthew McConaughey, by the way, he is. We think he may be helpful. There's a guy, you know, that's been hit by, or that had an accident, been in a car accident, and he's in this kind of between consciousness and unconsciousness. And Matthew McConaughey breaks his neck. That's the first thing he does it. Yep. And he does it to basically scare the shit out of everybody in the scene. And that's how we meet that's how we meet the actor Matthew McConaughey. Really?
Yeah, that and the fact that he's weirdly got like some kind of electronic brace on his leg that's always making noise when he walks.
Yeah, it's got like servo motor kind of sounds.
Yeah.
And it's really superhuman strength, this leg.
It's controlled by TV remotes, which I found really interesting.
I really found that interesting too, because he pulls up a box of loose remotes and he's trying to check out which one works and which one doesn't. And that, again, just felt visceral and tactile and vile and repugnant. Again,
yeah, it's totally. It's a nice weird touch though. And I think that was another thing that probably pushed me out of the movie when I was younger because I liked weird movies, but I think I just wasn't ready for this movie's weirdness. You know, and McConaughey, the force of McConaughey was too much for me.
He is so powerful in this movie, and it's a real tribute to him, to his acting, because he is not afraid. This is what, like, you know, this is like a first movie thing. You can kind of do whatever you want to. Now, I don't think he'd be able to play this role, but he can start out this way. The other thing is about this movie, another reason I will defend it, is that I think they're really working to make this movie work. Whether or not the story works, I think they're really working hard to make this into something. I don't think they're mailing any of this in at all. I think they're really behind it and trying to make a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think this Blu-ray definitely gave me a new appreciation for the craft, if you will, and the care that was definitely seeming to be taken. And yet, you know, you do get a sense of Kim Henkel's frustration with the film. I think Phil Noble Jr. introduces him as, like, reluctant to be
reluctant.
Even on the commentary.
I couldn't tell if that was because he said he may have a cold, or maybe that was something. Either way.
Could have been that. Yeah, you're
right. It sounds like everyone's reluctant to discuss this movie, but me and you. That's it.
Well, I mean, in the clips I found of Zellweger and McConaughey, they seem to have good memories of it. And
yeah.
So it doesn't seem like a movie they want to bury necessarily. Not necessarily either.
Get out in front of.
Yeah. You know, this is, put that in my list of credits whenever you list me, you know.
Right.
But yeah, like, I definitely have a different appreciation for it now.
Like, the new Judy Garland movie doesn't say Renee Zellweger from Texas Chainsaw Massacre for a New Generation. That's what you're saying.
It doesn't, yes. I don't know why, but. But yeah, no, I'm glad you were a fan enough of this one that I thought, like, this could be cool, you know, to check this out.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I did. It's, you know, like I said, not my favorite film, but it's a different, my feelings about
You're
it
very
now,
diplomatic right
I mean,
now.
But see, here's the thing. I told you, like, so I gave it 2 stars on Letterboxd, which doesn't sound like I like the movie.
Sure.
But really, it's much more about, again, I think I was telling you off mic, the feeling the movie gives me. It's unpleasant.
Yes.
And from that point of view, sometimes I rate things about feeling.
I think you're right. Because watching this movie again, like I said, it was like, oh, I got caught smoking and I had to smoke this whole pack and I got a little sick to my stomach. And that's how I felt watching it this time. Plus, my wife was in the room and she hadn't seen it. And she just kept saying, I don't like these kinds of movies over and over again. And I was like, well, look, I got to do the Blu-ray. I got to do the podcast. And and so she was sitting there working on her computer while I'm going through the movie and the commentary and all the interviews and everything. So, but which leads us to the next part. But
yeah.
I think every instinct that you have right now is also the right instinct. I think this is a vile, repugnant, disgusting movie that I'm totally fascinated by, and also I can take a break from watching it now.
Yeah, I'm good for a little bit, but again, in the context of watching, especially the McConaughey performance at the beginning, and then when we move into the beach bum, we can talk about him now and how much I love him as an actor.
Yes.
I just think he's legit one of my favorite presences in movies. He's just...
When he gets an opportunity to take something and run with it, he goes from being in some movies and going like, oh, there he is, here he is, here he is, he's good in that, he's great in this. And then you see him in, I don't know, True Detective, when he kind of just like was in that hypnotic McConaughey dream state the whole time. That's where I was like, wait a minute. He's doing something that he's been doing, and he really, really zeroed in on that, on something. Again, it's almost hypnotic, the way that he is, the way that he is so inside of that world.
Well, and so seemingly instinctual as an actor, just like not knowing nor questioning the choices he's making. Like, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of conscious decisions, but it feels like there's a lot of intuition with him, a lot of feelings that he translates into the performance on a level that is almost otherworldly.
I think. I don't see the seams in his performances at all. I mean, hopefully if the editor does the job, you won't see any of that stuff. But I do see, even in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4, he does so many terrible things. I mean, he crushes a woman's head with his foot, with his mechanical foot, and then howls and beats his chest and does all this crazy McConaughey stuff. He's covered in sweat and spit and he's cutting himself on his on his chest. He is, and he's ready to, like, he grabs a double barrel shotgun and points it at his face, and it's just committed, crazy, crazy committed acting where he, no one said stop, you know, it seems like, and then he and Renee Zellweger, again, those two, the scenes of them affecting each other are so crazy. This should scare the shit out of everybody. I mean, it should just make everybody feel gross. If everyone's okay with this, then it's no good. This is like, that's why this movie stuck in my head.
Yeah, one of my strongest memories from the movie, which I definitely did not forget, is there's a scene where they're in a room together in the house, the two of them.
Yeah.
And he's menacing her, and it was that was the one
that's what I'm thinking too.
That broke me. That was the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, oh, I just can't do this.
Yeah.
I can't, that first viewing.
Yeah.
But this time it was different. Maybe I'm a much sicker individual now, and
so who knows?
I'm able to do those things. But anyway,
I mean, at some point we also have to go like, oh, there's, you know, they have craft services. There's a pizza on the table, you know, and there is someone saying cut, and is everybody okay? And it's all play acting.
Yeah,
but it's all fake. But they really commit to it to a point where we're moved, even grossed out by it. Because they did such a great job. So I got to say, it's kind of a compliment that you felt like garbage after watching this.
Yeah.
And me too.
No, it's about the performance and the effectiveness of it. And yeah, it's good stuff in that way.
I got to say this. The guy who plays Leatherface.
Is he Robert Jacks, I think?
He is Robert Jacks. So Robert
Late
Jacks.
Robert Jacks apparently passed
away. Yeah, he passed away. But he was also a musician. I guess he has a song with Debbie Harry somewhere in the movie.
I missed that.
Yeah, they mentioned that in the thing.
Nice.
And he is really interesting. And he's like, I mean, everyone said that, you know, you got to know about this guy. He's like, he's tall and big and everything. But he is just the goofiest guy in the world. And he would just like turn on the rage. And just when the cameras were rolling, he would do horrible things. And then Leatherface kind of like tries on like different personalities throughout this whole thing, which is, I guess, alluded to in the first one. But I didn't really catch that as much. But he's a woman at one point, and he begins behaving like a woman towards the end. It's really, really odd and really bizarre.
Yeah.
I mean, just the fact that that Leatherface is kind of transitioning personalities. You know, another, just add that to the list of unique behaviors to this movie.
Yeah, I definitely didn't. There's layers to that performance that I feel like I missed.
You there's know? A lot going on.
Yeah.
When
McConaughey's fully blowing up, it's hard to not stare at that and then not see some of the other stuff.
Yeah.
I do like Joe Stevens, though, as like the other member of the family who speaks in like famous quotes.
Yeah, he's really interesting. Strange. And also he's menacing, too, because he's holding a shotgun and eloquently speaking.
The cattle prod stuff is really hard.
Oh. Horrible,
yeah. Just kept shocking Renee Zellweger. I was just like, oh, come on, just not that. Oh,
I dare you, listeners, to watch this. And I don't know. I mean, I dare you. There, accept the dare or don't.
Okay, so let's talk about these features. So what did you, I didn't get all the way through the commentary. What, did you glean in any gems from that?
I gleaned the thing that, again, like, I'm always looking for just, I want to know how they got to this fevered pitch inside of this movie, and I feel like I had a strong understanding of that by them talking about McConaughey and his bravado and him just going for it and stuff and nobody stopping him. And Kim Henkel, it sounds like he's one of those directors who didn't kind of got out of the way of actors, which is, I'm finding, you know, in lots of different places, this thing happens where the actors get together outside of the director and start going, we're going to make this movie. It's like Alien. You know, Ridley Scott's worrying about production catching on fire, this, that, the other thing, making sure everything's built, where the camera goes, you know, where the light is, where all that stuff is. And meanwhile, you've got this Yaphet Kotto, and you've got Sigourney Weaver, and no one's talking to her because she's like the angry school marm. So they're all treating her like shit on set because that's how they're going to treat her in the movie. And so they're building a world and a troop kind of outside of the narrative and within it at the same time. And I see that kind of thing happening in acting. And I think that's a lesson to learn from this thing, too, is to go, if you hire really great casts, if you hire really great talent, and hopefully you can just get out of the way. I was watching Empire of Dreams, the big Star Wars, you know, 2.5-hour documentary that takes you through the whole thing. And you kind of feel that way with Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher. Where George Lucas is like, oh, I got to get the shot, I got to do this, I got to, oh my God, I have to build these sets, I have to do all this stuff. And they're like, we know what we're going to do, right? And they kind of get together and they work as a troop and they kind of, they dictate the performance, you know? Their personalities are really working. I mean, if we don't have Han Solo with Luke Skywalker and that relationship, we don't have Star Wars. If we don't have the humanity between that kind of relationship, we don't have Star Wars. So I feel like I got some of that out of this commentary and understood that a little bit better. Beyond that, I think a lot of questions kept coming up to and putting poor Kim Hankel on the spot, going like, what is with the Illuminati? What are you trying to say? And he wasn't really punting, but I mean, he was saying to a degree that I just kind of wrote it and I thought, you know, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. This movie, I think, is kind of deliberately showing that this character comes in with a limousine and has a driver and checks in and he's got burn marks on his chest and nipple rings and weird door knocker, you know, things on his body. And we're just meant to believe, okay. And I just thought, what a weird, weird thing. I certainly would never expect that out of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie.
Nope.
That there's some other world, and then the final sequence, an airplane comes out, like a biplane comes out of nowhere and kind of participates in helping Renee Zellweger. Some kind of deus ex machina, some hand of God comes down and corrects things, you know?
I was confused. We won't spoil the last shot, but it did confuse me a little bit. I don't know if it's like a sound that she's hearing that's supposed to be the thing that's showing continued madness or something like that.
But. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm not sure either.
Okay.
Who knows?
Just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I watched both endings just to make sure I was like, okay, all right. But anyway,
I think the nightmare's never over.
Yeah, it doesn't matter for me. Yeah, nightmare's never over. I mean, that's totally a simple,
I think that's what it is, yeah.
Simple out, but.
Yeah. And then also just echoes of the first one, because nothing's going to beat the first ending of the first shot, which is basically Leatherface dancing and whipping his chainsaw around in a gorgeously lit kind of dawn of a new day kind of a thing. It's so absurd, so weird, so vile and celebratory.
Yeah, celebratory, I was just thinking that, celebratory,
you know,
totally.
Even though they're, you know, the girl gets away, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's funny to even try to articulate what this movie is, but I guess I'm kind of, I feel like whenever I find something fascinating in any genre, I'm trying to, in my mind, figure out what that cocktail of horribleness is that makes me go, oh, whoa, take it easy, everybody. Because this is different than a lot of like torture porn. Because sometimes they'll show, like, you know, a nail driving into a kneecap or something horrible like that. Right. Doesn't sound good. And for some reason, this isn't that. They don't really show a lot of, I mean, everything kind of happens and it's implied. And it's also just people keeping people captive and enjoying being vile. And that's what Matthew McConaughey really does. And again, that's what makes him a brave actor, quote unquote, I think, is that he really delights in menace throughout this whole movie. There you go.
Yeah, no, it's definitely.
So that's commentary. That's kind of what I learned from that. But we've got other special features.
Yeah, there's a couple interviews. There is a If Looks Could Kill, a 19-minute interview with the special effects creator, J.M. Logan, and the production designer, Deborah Pastor.
I try to put myself in the mindset of the characters when thinking about what props to have about and how things look. And considering that Vilmer was a tow truck driver who killed the people in the cars that he picked up, he would have an overabundance of keys. So I think Anne Iswell, the art director, she came up with the idea of putting all the keys on the wall or nailing them up on the wall.
The corpse in the bathtub. One morning we came in and the entire house just stunk so terribly. It smelled like rotting flesh. It smelled like, I don't even know what it was. And of course I got blamed for that, for, you know, using biological materials and, you know, that there's something in there rotting and something's terrible. It had turned out that someone had gotten very drunk and vomited into the tub with the dead body in it. And that's what was causing the terrible smell.
Where's the phone? I'm calling the cops.
Boy, you are as dull as ditch water.
Yeah, right.
This was an empty house, and Kim wanted it big and messy, and we had to fill it, and we didn't have a budget to buy anything. So I traveled far and wide around the county looking for people who give me stuff for free, looking at old storage spaces, walking across West Texas and looking for cattle bones. I went down to the local taxidermy place, Martinez Taxidermy, which is still there today, told those fellows what I was doing, asked if I could have their leftover bones, which they thought was odd, but they took me to the back and there were piles of bones in the back, javelina jaws. they let me take as many as I wanted, and I would go back and replenish when I, you know, whenever they had more.
Right.
Which was cool. I mean, it was interesting. It was his first movie, I think, or one of his first big
jobs.
It sounds
like he was like probably 18 or 19 when this movie came out, so it's got to be something like that. And you can see little clips and shots and again, lots of life casts of faces and things and to make the leather faces and stuff. So I think he did a great job. And sometimes that's what it takes, is a kid who really has a shot and really works hard and busts his ass.
Case in point, Rob Bottin.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's that kind of thing.
So. Oh, man. I mean, he put himself through the ringer.
Yep. But we're all the better for it.
I know.
I like the production designer's comments, too. Like,
yeah,
she
very thoughtful. Yeah. And she really did a lot of, it seems like she did a lot of hard work to stay true to a lot of the feelings of the original.
Yeah.
Which I think does show up.
Yeah, definitely. And then we had an interview with Tyler Shea Cohn, who is like sort of the douchebaggy jerk that were... He reminded me weirdly of Ben Affleck and Sam Levine squished together in one. In terms of the way that he looked.
Oh, that's funny.
And the way that he talked. I don't know. Yeah. There's something about that.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that.
But,
sure.
You know, it's an actor interview. It was fine. It was interesting to hear his recollections. He had some...
He's one of the only actors that went on record having been in the movie. And that was his first gig. And he was pretty great as that character because everyone, either the compliment or the insult that everyone gave him is, oh, this guy is the character. So,
yes, the asshole.
And real asshole, yeah.
And then I didn't get to watch the Buzz Is Back, an interview with director of photography Levi Isaacs.
Yeah, so...
do you remember that one?
I do, not much though. I think he's also kind of like everyone's kind of recounting where they were 25, 26 years ago.
Yeah.
And everyone's a little clouded, but I don't have too many recollections okay. of it, to be honest. But
that's fair. I mean, that's pretty much it for these special features.
But I have to say, once they get inside of the house, that's where the movie kind of really takes off into this super fast-paced, horrible, horrible nightmare. And a lot of that is that cinematography. There's a lot of handheld stuff that happens. There's a lot of but they're repeating motives, you know, motifs that I think probably upset people, but they're kind of done really well though. So I don't know.
Yeah. No,
I don't know who I'm trying to sell on this thing anymore. I don't understand why I am.
Well, I do think it's interesting to watch it in conjunction with our next movie.
Yes.
Just in terms of like an unhinged, no holds barred performance.
Without a doubt.
You know?
Yeah.
So let's move into that.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Which one did you watch first?
I watched Texas Chainsaw first.
Okay. Interesting.
I wanted to go chronological.
Got it. Okay.
You know, kind of see the difference.
Okay. So you hadn't seen this movie prior to... So we're talking about the movie Beach Bum.
Yes.
Which is Harmony Korine.
What's going on, guys? Hey, is the lounge you're in?
No.
Lingerie's not in?
No.
Where is it?
Jamaica.
Ah, oh, the magical stoner. Catch your drift, man. Your science is cold with me.
So what's with the guns? Huh?
You guys ever watch Magnum P.I.? It's based on my life. I watch it all the time. It's like looking in the fucking mirror. All right. Catch you later. Hey, let them know Moondog came by, huh?
Well, it was obvious pretty early for me that it was about all rhyme and not reason. It was about all music and not arithmetic. And I like to come at characters from a very logical place, and I threw that out the window pretty quickly with Moondog. And he was just, he's sort of a mosh pit of a bunch of cats I run into in my travels. A guy named Chris Kringle. And poor Douglas, Australia, who sits on the beach every evening, 2 6-foot speakers jamming loud, staring out at an island that's about 50 miles out there that he can or cannot see, just talking to the people over there, and he's pretty damn sure they're talking back to him. He may be right. There's another guy, Captain Steve, down in Nevis, one of those guys that has that perpetual line of saliva stuck right there, greases, because he's always kind of smoking. And he was a guy I met, and he was married to a woman, Eileen. They've been married for 27 years, had a beautiful daughter, and I asked him how they met, and he tells me a long story about working on an oil rig and off the coast of Florida and coming in every Friday night and going to this little lady dancing bar, and there was a certain set of legs in the back with these silk stockings, and man, he just loved those legs, man. And I kept asking her to take her out of my boat for lunch, and she kept saying no, and the eighth time I went back, she said yeah. And so I took her out on Sunday in my boat, tooling around the bay. Just as I saw the opening head out of the ocean, I pulled out there, and I just kept fucking going, man. Kidnapped his now wife and sailed around the world on their very first date. And it was a beautiful love story, but it was like, okay, that's one of those guys. He's also a little bit of Tom Petty. He's also sort of a folk poet out of a Dylan song. So he's a mosh pit of a bunch of those. And yeah, he's a guy, like I said, all music. I mean, his art is his life and the way he approaches it. He runs into pleasure, he runs into pain. He very quickly feels that that's the next note in the song of his life that he's conducting.
Yes, I had not seen it. I had been wanting to see it
mm-hmm.
with some reservations because I think Harmony is a very interesting filmmaker. But yeah, it's a similar thing in some ways to Texas Chainsaw in terms of the films. I mean, his films...
They can get pretty vile.
They can get vile. They can get weird.
Yeah. They can get really dark.
Surreal.
But I think there's always some kind of human connection, even in like Gummo, where I'm fascinated with Gummo. And
Gummo
is a tough watch, too. But I'm totally fascinated with how he tells stories. I think he's got like a lot of that Herzog stuff. It feels like Stroyczyk, you know, at times inside of... Which is a very dark movie that they kind of call a comedy at the same time, Werner Herzog's movie. But this one is, I mean, he started out with Kids, and he went from Kids, you know, as a writer to Gummo as a director, and it's an undeniable film. And so I'll always check out what he's doing. And I did not know what this movie was going to be. I remember seeing the poster and going, I don't understand, this is a comedy, this isn't a comedy, what is this thing? And I just saw online somebody said, oh, this is worth checking out. And I was like, that's enough for me, I guess I'll go take a look.
Yeah, I think you had said that you enjoyed it, and that was the other thing that clicked in my head is like, oh, I want to see that. I know he liked it. He likes this other McConaughey movie. Let's do this.
They're very similar films.
Yes, very similar. No, I didn't know what to expect either.
So what did you think?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, I love that it opens with McConaughey gibberish. It's literally just him wandering down the street, almost not making any sense. And then he starts to make sense. He picks up a white cat.
Yeah.
He's walking around with a cat, and it's bizarre.
Say, 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 so. Many, 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 my, my, my.
Hey.
Hey, 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 hey. That's Tito Albino. Catito Hermosa, my little angel pussy. Nobody? Anybody?
He mostly has like, keep going.
I just love the sense of the Florida Keys that
yes.
apparently, you know, Harmony Korine lives down in Florida and
yeah.
he loves Florida
yeah.
and he gives a great sense of it. And it's a beautiful looking movie. Like there's a great shot early on where McConaughey has the kitten on his lap, I think, and he's next to, I think, a bridge, and he's got a tall PBR balanced on his knee, which is actually a common thing. He drinks a lot of tall PBRs in this movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, the film is crawling with odd compositions, like
yeah.
some dude playing a trombone on a dock, or McConaughey tapping on a bongo while a giant white snake crosses over it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they're sitting in a bar and shooting pool, and some dude is like shirtless with like a giant like plastic creature hand
on his, know,
just like weird little touches like that. I was just like, oh wow, he's really. And again, I think we were talking about McConaughey and his sense of instinct.
Yeah.
And I think Harmony Korine is very much that kind of a filmmaker. Just like, I don't know why this guy is with this tuba on the dock. It just feels right, you know?
Yeah.
And he has that sense. And so anyway, I think it's a really interesting movie in that I didn't realize, I thought it would just be like a stoner movie, but then
yeah.
you come to find out more that he is, McConaughey's character, his name is Moondog,
yeah.
and he is somewhere between, say, Charles Bukowski and Hunter Thompson,
yeah.
but even way, way more out there than those guys.
Yeah.
Moondog is the most prolific poet in Key West, Florida.
So help me out, I'm going to throw a few fresh lines on you, a little poem I'm working on right now. Last night, when I went to bed in Havana, I was thinking about you. I was thinking about you. And I got up at about 4 a.m. and I had to take a piss, as guys do, and I looked down at my dick. And I had such affection in my heart when I did. Knowing that it had been inside you twice today. Made me feel beautiful. Look out! That's what I got. Have a great night. Chase the moon.
And he's this poetic artist who is almost can't not be truthful. I mean, I know that that's not a part of this thing, but there's something so honest in every single moment of McConaughey's on-screen presence. And what they did, because I went inside unseen. I had no idea what the story was about other than McConaughey's in it and Harmony Korine. And I remember seeing bits and pieces of little clips or something like that, and I couldn't believe this is a Harmony Korine movie. And I see all the fingerprints, because he does do this great thing where it's almost like Herzog, where he's got, you know, trained actors and regular people interacting and being somewhat truthful, you know. And I'd say 100% truthful if it got into this movie, because and then in the backdrop of Florida too, because those skies are something else. It's like in the Florida Project too, just those beautiful back. They're just huge skies with so much cloud information and diffuse lighting and all the things that make it's almost constantly magic hour in every single moment of this movie too.
Yeah, it's a different sunny than California.
Yeah, and it feels like there's a little color correction going on, but I'm totally on board. And like Terrence Malick shot like Tree of Life, like those beach sequences and those same kinds of beaches in Florida too. So it's one of the most gorgeous backdrops. I have a friend that lives in Florida, and I've been watching all these movies, and I was just talking to him and I was like, how about those skies? And he's like, dude, you don't understand. I just stand outside my house and I just look up, and that's all I do that day. Wow. And it's just that gorgeous and godlike, these skies. And I love looking at those things in movies, just natural occurring beauty and all that stuff. So it's cinematic in a really unique way. And you're right, and all these little bells and whistles that are happening around him befriending a kitty cat. And
well, I mean, and then there's all kinds of great performances that pop up that accompany his. You got Snoop Dogg, who plays a character named Lingerie, and he's like fucking great.
Yeah.
Isla Fisher plays his wife. She's great. His daughter's great.
Yeah. She's so funny in this movie. Everyone's just in that same kind of, especially her and McConaughey, they have a very unique relationship.
So much.
And it seems to work.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing this movie really does well that I was really blown away by is that he's supposed to be a poet. And then his poetry and him delivering his poetry makes you believe that this could be a real poet delivering this poetry and affecting people. And Jimmy Buffett's in it, and he wanders on stage with him and says one of his poets. And you just believe that this is part of the movie. And all these crowds that are there, they feel like they're all parts. It's such a huge pastiche of reality and staged things that I don't see where the seam is half the time. And that's another amazing thing that I hadn't seen before in a movie.
Yeah, no, and he does things with like jump cuts where you'll be in the middle of a scene and it's that new wave feeling. It's not explained and it doesn't matter. It feels like, it gives you a sense of almost being unstuck in time or something. It was like this weird.
It's stony. I mean, it's
stony. Yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
it's like it's trippy.
Yeah.
This is a movie. And I'll tell you this: that if you use medical marijuana, it pairs well with this film. Not so much the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 4, but this, yes, without a doubt, because this is a trippy movie. And what you just said was one of my favorite kind of things that I didn't even notice until like the second viewing, is that they're really cobbling together a bunch of takes to turn it into a moment or a scene or a feel or something. And because the audio is so strong, or maybe they did some ADR to really kind of make it all feel like it's smooth, it all really works.
Yeah, like if you were to listen to the scene, you wouldn't have any sense that there's any jumping around at
all. But you can tell that they're improvising. You can tell that there's like some in-the-moment real stuff. I know when I'm watching Jonah Hill, I'm kind of like watching a little bit more like outside and going like, oh yeah, there's some improv happening here.
Jonah Hill is fucking fantastic in this movie. He's his literary agent. And he's got like a weird, like, southern.
Sounds like Louisiana to me. He's like,
"It breaks my heart, Moondog. It breaks my heart because you a motherfucking has been, boy."
Whatever the fuck that is that a bad thing?
God damn, it's a bad thing, Moondog. As your forever agent, I feel obliged to be truthful with you at all times.
You're a shitty agent.
It's sad, Moondog. You used to be a motherfucking ATM for me, boy. You have pissed away your talent on women and booze and total excess.
Now you're talking. Yeah, all those things, that's what feeds the juices up here in my nugget, man. Through my loins, up the Autobahn, my spirit and mind, man. I'm moist right now. I'm lubricated.
Yeah, but you the fastest horse in my stable, boy. You think I want to take a motherfucking shotgun, put it in your mouth, blow your brains all over my nice motherfucking clothes?
That's the fucking Lewis I'm talking about.
You think I want to do that? You was a revolutionary rider. You were a radical. Your words meant something to people.
Either way, it's a good thing I'm rich, Lewis. Especially since I'm well hung.
You ain't rich, Moondog. Your wife's rich.
That's true.
And it's been a while since I had you in me, but you ain't well hung, boy. You ain't well hung.
Get in there now.
I
Come
mean,
on,
God
there.
Damn. God.
San Francisco standoff, baby?
Oh! I don't know where that character voice
it's
was
great.
From.
I mean, yeah. It's just great. You know, and then Zac Efron shows up later with one of the craziest haircut and facial hair things. Like, I heard an interview with Harmony Korine. I didn't know if he was joking or not, but he didn't seem to punctuate it as a joke. And he said, "I was looking at a panini." And I was thinking,
that's hilarious.
And if you look at
his face does look like a panini. It's a very complicated facial hairstyle.
Yes.
Take a lot of upkeep.
But that's a great, like, that's what the movie does. And I love when movies can do it, and I've talked about it before, but bringing in, like, an actor like that at the three-quarter mark or whatever, and then and then they're gone, or what, you know what I mean? Like, just pulling those actors in for those small roles, and you're just like, oh, man, that just energized the movie. That just boosted the movie.
Without a doubt, and I think Zac Efron really, really does a great job in this film.
I like him more and more all the time.
I think he just really gives a shit, and he's got the goods, you know?
Yeah, no, he's trying interesting stuff.
I mean, he's always been talented, but I think he's got that, like, pretty boy kind of thing he's got to deal with, which is, like, what McConaughey had to deal with, and, like, you know,
but the
guys. What are they gonna, poor guy. Oh, let's cry me a river. Right?
But the ability to make fun of yourself is one of my favorite things.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And people that don't have a sense of that, can't laugh at themselves, I almost indubitably do not get along with. It's just one of those things, like...
Well, there's nothing more terrifying than someone that doesn't have a sense of humor.
It's really awful.
It's drop-dead frightening. It's one of the most scary things in the world to come toe-to-toe with someone that doesn't have a sense of humor. There's something not human about them.
Yeah, that's really what
but
it comes down
it
to.
It really is, yeah. There's something like, oh, yeah. It's like when people say, "I just don't like dogs. I just never liked them." I mean, you're saying is noted to a big part of humanity. but without a doubt, this keeps on zigging and zagging in ways that I remember it kind of reaches like past the 25-minute mark where I don't necessarily know where this story is going.
No. Nope.
And I don't even really want to say what happens because I think I don't think you need to know. What you do is you float through it with this crazy spirit that is Matthew McConaughey. Mm-hmm. And he is some kind of angelic ghost. And he's also not perfect. It's one of my favorite moments. It's like it reminds me of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, where there is a tuba player kind of like playing and rocking near a dock. And Matthew McConaughey is either totally drunk or high or something almost in every moment of this thing. And he just walks by and pushes him in the water and bends over and just starts howling and laughing and laughing. And it made me laugh so hard. It was such a evil, vile thing to do, but so fucking funny because he's like Harpo Marx, just destroying the fabric of time everywhere he goes and
that's so
challenging all things that he could possibly. Yeah, it's.
I like that. I like that Harpo Marx take. I mean, there could be. I mean, I don't know that that's in there from his point of view, but I think you can definitely read it. I think you can definitely say there's something. It's just it's a really interesting. Complex guy.
He's destroying everything that is part of modern man's belief system kind of throughout that. Almost like Harpo Marx. I think about Harpo.
You're right.
Harpo in, what is it, Duck Soup, where he's got the scissors.
Yep,
and he's just cutting everything to shreds, to ribbons, and gluing people together and doing things and wrecking things and making people hold his pant leg.
Oh,
and
I love
hold
that
his,
bit. That's one of my favorite gags.
I know. It's so funny, but... You just can't. It's like having a dog. You're like, okay, you're going to destroy everything in my life, and it's okay because that's your natural thing, and you're not doing it in an evil way. You're doing it because it's playful.
Yeah, and you are a good soul at the end
exactly,
of the day,
yeah.
And it's all about you know, not to be cliched, but living his best life, which is what he's trying to do.
Yeah,
really,
without a doubt.
The goal at the end of the day is to do that. And
isn't it crazy? So
there's something admirable about it. In this.
Well, this is the oddest thing that I could even start articulating in my mind as I'm watching this, because I'm watching it the first time and I'm just bewildered and engaged and totally inside of the movie. And, you know, only every once in a while. I mean, hopefully if I'm watching a movie, I'm just watching the movie and I'm engaged and I'm not going like, oh, how much time is going? Okay, all right, we're in act. Too. Okay, it's going to take a while. Okay, oh, we got to do
when
this.
You start breaking it down.
Yeah, when I start breaking it down, going, here I am, I'm bored in a piece of entertainment where you've created the most terrible, like, this is the worst thing that any entertainer could possibly do is leave an audience hanging, be bored, not be entertaining, not have them be engaged. You can confuse people, that's fine. You can be weird, that's fine, but don't bore us. You can't do it. And this movie had nothing close to that. But no. At some point, I'm realizing, whoa, wait a minute. Harmony Korine's making an optimistic film. I think he's saying something about the artist's life. I think he's probably saying a lot about himself. What do I know? I don't know him. But I think here's a guy that's compelled to create. And I don't know if he's getting rich doing it or what, but he's not stopping. And I'm really excited that he's not stopping. And I'm excited that he can go from, again, so he's almost like McConaughey, where he goes from kids gummo to this heavenly, strange experience. And it really is a cinematic experience, I think.
Totally, yeah. It's one of my favorite films of the year, for sure.
Yeah, totally got on my list, like, early on.
Yeah, I wish I'd seen it sooner, but I'm kind of glad that it came up in this organically. And I don't know.
Yeah.
It made me admire him more. It made me admire Harmony Korine more. I was reading some interviews with him, and he seems to have an attitude...
Harmony,
yeah.
Yeah.
He seems to have an attitude sort of along the lines of Moondog, which is like... You know, like I said, he lives down in Florida. He doesn't engage in political discourse.
Right.
He's not interested in that at all.
You know, for me, it was a lot about going to the Keys and seeing a certain type of person that, you know, I love hanging out down there. This kind of, like, embraces this idea of, like, a lack of ambition, celebrates that I was like that. And, you know, not really paying attention to politics, or it's more about, like, sunset and the weed and the houseboats and... It's a more of about a character who is chasing bliss in a certain cosmic vibration, let's say. And so, and I also like the idea that he's just totally unhinged and seeking pleasure. So whatever feels good, he just runs toward it. And I like the idea of a character who also has a kind of genius in him, but it's more of like a burden. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's got these blessings that have been bestowed. And at the same time, it's just he has total disregard and contempt. It's almost like we're saying, it's like the poetry is the life.
Yeah,
he really just talks about, like, hanging out with his kids, drinking Mountain Dew, eating Taco Bell, and playing online poker or something.
Sure.
And that is, like, it. Like, he's just, and then creating, obviously.
Well, I mean, this is one of those, I mean, imagine trying to make a movie that kind of tries to encapsulate what poetry life can have. It's a really hard...
I mean, just trying to wrap your head around that.
I know.
The allegory of it, or the metaphor of it,
uh-huh,
whatever it is. Yeah, you're right. He totally pulls that off.
I think it's one of the most difficult things, and I don't know if he started out doing that or what, but this movie is filed under a comedy, and I do see why it is comedy,
yeah.
And I do see why it's something like, again, close to Terrence Malick in Gravity, you know? But talking about the Blu-ray, I got it in front of me. What we have here is the greatest special feature, I'd say, is chapter selection. audio. There's an audio on it. There are no special features on
it. It's
got
audio. That's great.
So we had this conversation before we really checked out what the Blu-ray had.
No, I know. Well, it's a bummer because I'm glad we watched the movie.
It's a beach bummer is what it is.
It is a beach bummer. But I'm glad we watched the movie. I'm also kind of not surprised that mm-hmm. he's not a big... Like, one of the interviews I read, he said something like... Do people even buy DVDs anymore?
Right, yeah.
He's like, I don't think my kids have ever touched one.
Right.
You know,
right.
And stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, that's a fair point.
It's probably true.
And he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that wants to be overly analytical about what he's doing. He just kind of does it. Kind of like McConaughey. Like
I think you could be totally right about that. Who knows? I mean, I think maybe more with Harmony Korine, because look what we're doing. We're just talking about this thing and trying to imply what we think. And
yeah.
we're kind of meeting in the same place that we have a similar feeling of this movie. And it's something to start discussions about. It's funny. I don't know who else saw this movie. And I don't know who else is... I've seen some people say they really liked it a lot.
There are like some really interesting, weird movies that came out this year that are breaking a lot of rules that are some kind of maybe a new style of filmmaking. I don't know. I put this kind of in the category of Under the Silver Lake.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think these are dreamy, really stony, cinematic, interesting, this kind of inward journey, you know? So, yeah, I like that movie a lot, too. That's like one of the movies of the year for me as well. And not so much, you know, classic storytelling. Maybe there is classic. There's classic structure underneath us, whether or not he wants there to be. But these are like, this is like an interesting, maybe some kind of style of filmmaking that I don't even know what to call. But it's something.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, I mean, Mandy's kind of in this thing too. You know, I'd put them all in some kind of like stony kind of nightmarish or dreamlike.
Surreal
kind of.
There's definitely a component of surreality to all three of those films, which I think is one of my favorite things in cinema right now. Surreal cinema. I mean, it's one of my favorite things in general in movies, but it's such an interesting thing to try to be dreamlike and not be logical and to be absurdist, I think.
And then also be cinematic, like crazy cinematic too. And again, just really using the full, you know, and all these movies are shot in, I think, anamorphic there or wide or I think 185, one maybe beach bum. I don't know if it gets that wide, but people are shooting digital, and they have been shooting digital for a while, but within the last, I don't know, the last 10 years, but even more so, it's easier to get better old-fashioned lenses for, like, your Red Dragons and stuff like that. So your camera, so you can get these anamorphic lenses. You can get these Panavision anamorphic lenses that have imperfections. The same, you can actually rent the same kind of lenses that they use in the 1960s and like John Ford movies and stuff like that.
That's
and I think people are getting their hands on those kinds of things. And I think really exploring cinematography. Again, cinematography, I think, keeps kind of notching up in a really interesting way. And I've seen some really cool things this past year also that kind of take that, like Escape at Dannemora, the TV show.
Yeah, you were telling me about
it. Blows me away, the camera. Like, again, it's like 1970s, long lenses from very far away, pushed in, getting these warped backgrounds and these really kind of tall character shots and really cool stuff. That's a great new DP also in that one.
Nice. Yeah, no, I like the idea of, as technology gets better and we can have the more perfect, clean image, that there are filmmakers who always go, nah, I don't really want that.
I want it warped and I want it to look cool.
I want to do something else with it. Isn't something I'm interested in.
Yeah, without a doubt.
So anyway, I'm glad we both dug this movie. I thought it was really interesting to juxtapose the two performances.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, but there's something that carries on through from the first to the second, which is that here's a guy that is interesting. First of all, he's just an interesting guy. I mean, he's also just, it seems like he's completely free to explore these characters while the camera's running.
Yeah.
And he seems like he is unafraid and knows that, you know, that is a safe place for actors to, why not go fucking bonkers as long as it's feeling like it's coming from a real place. And I think he really, there's something grounded and human about all these things, even if he's like fucked up out of his mind in this movie, which he is 90% of this movie. It seems like he's just so high or so drunk or.
Well, he told another great story in a Q&A about how Snoop Dogg had a scene with him and they had to smoke a joint together. It was like a 7 or 8 minute scene.
Sure. And I'm sure.
And he did smoke a joint with Snoop Dogg. But then like when they finished the scene, Snoop was like, dude, that's not prop weed. That's Snoop weed. And he was like fucking wasted for the rest of the day.
Apparently. Oh, of course. I'm sure if you smoked pot, by the way, I was, so I, you know, during Metalocalypse, Snoop Dogg was working on some kind of a thing at the same place. So we'd know when Snoop Dogg was using them, like edit one is what we called it. Cause he'd sit there and log lots of hours and just frame fuck things or whatever, work stuff out or color correct. You'd just be in this one big edit room. And we knew when Snoop was there for like 2 weeks after, cause it would just smell like the most dank fucking Snoop Dogg weed in the world. And it was pretty cool. I don't know how I would be able to mix anything being high out of my mind.
I mean, that guy's functioning like McConaughey on a different plane. And
so
they kind of go really well together. The scenes with them, the scenes with Jimmy Buffett and Snoop Dogg are great. I mean, it's a really fascinating.
Isla Fisher is so funny too.
She's great.
I like seeing her in movies.
I do too. I like the trend of her getting cast in a lot of stuff.
Like, yeah.
So, I don't know. But anyway, we should probably wrap this up. But this is a high recommend for this show.
Yeah, there's a low recommend and a high recommend.
I mean, it's a recommend because I think it's...
One is a recommend, the other is a dare.
Yeah. Well, yes. But I would also say that if you do watch Texas Chainsaw 4, try and chase it with the beach bum, because I think it's a really intriguing experience, honestly.
One will bring you down, one will bring you right back up.
Exactly. And that's exactly where McConaughey wants you to be, man.
All right, all right. He does say all right, all right, all right in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4.
I missed that. All right, everybody have a wonderful and Blu-ray-filled week. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you,
Landon. See you later,
guys.